To record.
Here we are. So what I will do is I will rush really quickly through that through the set of slides. It's the third time that you see them, but I promise you we will finish them very soon. So very quickly, just wanted to remind you the most important things. So observing a correlation in the world, which kind of gives us an idea of a hypothesis, can mean anything. Many possible graphs. In case of two variables, maybe three variables, here are the graphs that are possible that explain the correlations. I cautioned you not to to use experimentation whenever really needed, because it's an expensive tool. It costs a lot of effort to perform an experiment. Then I flash the threats to internal and external validity. There is a funny movie that most of you have seen in this introduction to the doctoral studies, the fundamental tools of scientists' workbench. Remember the Moses joke with the 15 commandments, if you remember? You don't? If I have a moment, I'll play that. I'm surprised you don't. You have never seen it. We don't have speakers here, so you will not be able to hear the voices anyway. Moses comes down the mountain with three tablets, and he says, "Hey, listen, guys, I have 15, and stone table falls down, it crumbles into pieces. I have 10 commandments for you." It's a joke. I hope nobody is insulted by that. It's just a joke.
They didn't like seventh rule also.
Yeah, they do.
About that, and they wanted to delay that.
Yeah.
That's how we write seven.
Yeah. People love those round numbers. There's nothing round, nothing unusual about eight. In fact, somebody, maybe one of you, can discover a ninth one. So treat this just as a checklist. Nothing magical about it. The same these four, people have discovered it over time. It's not just one person. People described, this design can have an alternative hypothesis, a rival hypothesis, so be careful, watch it. And nothing magical about the number, as I said. The notation, which you probably got used to it, and then we talked about the several designs. This was the simplest. I don't think it's done very often, because that assumes that you know nothing about the state of the world. You do something, you observe something, and then you assume that observation was due to your action. So I look at, I bounce with my tool, look outside and say, oh, because I bounce my tool, it's cloudy now, right? That's ridiculous, of course. So this is just for completeness, I guess. This is a design that we probably do a lot every day. You observe, it's cloudy, then I do some, magic, look around and see if there is cloudy. It's still cloudy, right? So I have something to compare to. Very simple design, and I bet all of you on a daily basis experiment. Those of you who have small children, you probably see children do that a lot. They just look at your face, do something bad, and look again. Very simple way of experimenting. Please remind me to check your presence at the end. Check presence. So this is a common experiment that is done by many, very often. It is subject to several problems. We talked about them in detail. Five of this of the list. Let's see. I talked about then the history, maturation. We talked about testing. If you remember, the first test influences the second test. Instrumentation. The idea here is that you are using an instrument that is decalibrated in the meantime during that experiment. Statistical regression. That was cool, if you remember. I spent a longer time explaining how it works. It works typically, we are dealing with it when the subjects are chosen based on a single extreme score. Because if you pick people randomly from the population, that thing will not work. but a single extreme score, and there is a chance that next time you measure that person, that subject, that device, things are going to be closer to the mean, towards the mean. So we talked about this. At some point we will be done. This one is an interesting experiment, the third one. Two groups of people, control and treatment. We do an experimentation like that too. There is a joke. He was so ingrained in doing science that he sent one of his children to Sunday school and kept the other one at home as control. It's a joke. Sunday school is religia lesson. So essentially we have two groups, and we do something to one group and then keep the other just to look at it, okay, to see if there is a difference. There are also problems with this one. The main problem is selection, because there is no randomization. The selection is a problem. How did you select those two groups? The experiments that we often do are in naturally occurring settings. So let's say two sections of the same class, the same lecture. We have laboratory exercises, one at 9 o'clock, the other one at 2 o'clock, 2 p.m. And if you have reasons to think that the groups are identical, it's fine. But sometimes the groups are not identical, because maybe they like coming in the morning, the other ones like coming in the afternoon. They're just a little bit different in terms of people. So selection is a problem. Mortality is another one. It's when people exit the study because of the treatment. If they exit the study because of the treatment, then the two groups are different at the end just because of this exit. Classical example, experiment with exercise and weight. People who are very obese may exit that study because it's too difficult for them. And by that only, that group will become lighter on the average. Then we had two experiments with randomization. We talked about this in the context of causal graphs also. So this is the first really experimental design with randomization. We do something and then we test again. That's quite nice. If there is anything that happens in terms of history, maturation, testing, instrumentation, regression, then it is going to be, and the selection is going to be compensated, because if there is anything happening, let's say history, then it happens to both groups. Of course, you have to always use common sense. If you have one group at 11 o'clock, the other one at 2 o'clock, and there was fire announced at 11:30, of course, that has influence. So always watch out for history. Maturation, if it's all at the same time, it happens to both groups. You can compensate for that. Because you randomize, the groups are the same, practically. Remember, I said a long story last week involving, we have this. I was telling about miracles. We talked about this, the interaction of testing and X. So you make the subject sensitive to the treatment by the pretest. So that can happen. A classical example from the textbook is this movie that I told you about. We were here already, right? This was there last week. If not, then you think we stopped here somewhere? Okay, no problem. We can go back. So we stopped at this design. Yes. Okay. Great. So I should spend a little bit more time on that. We did talk about how it dealt with different problems, I hope, in instrumentation, regression, and selection. Essentially, you have two groups, two sets of measurements to compensate for that, to kind of see what happens. The only difference between the groups, the two groups, is the treatment. So whatever difference there is between 2 and 4, O2 and O4, it's because of that treatment. So when you do an experiment, you have to really be very, very careful to make sure that that is the only difference. Sometimes a small thing may make a difference. The way you smile, the way you do something to people, the way you treat animals, or, you know, you can influence the group. But otherwise, well, this should be the only group. A selection is dealt with through randomization. I wonder why I told you about this miracles, the leg and stuff at this point. I should have said it a little later. I'll come back to that. So I said it in advance. I'll use it a little later. Maybe there was another reason for that. Maybe I talked about this in the context of equality of the groups. Because we randomize, the groups are equal. They're identical, really, from the point of view of statistics. Of course, it can happen that they are not identical. If I do a randomization here, I flip a coin for everybody and assign you to two groups, it can happen that all the ladies will be in one group and all the gentlemen in the other group. It can happen. But the probability of that is really very, very small, really small. So if you have a sufficiently large set of subjects, data sets, animals or people, whatever, the probability is on your side. Just randomization will pretty much generate the groups to be equal. Remember the story I told you about the bathtub with one part of the bathtub boiling, the other one freezing? It can happen according to the theory, the thermodynamics. It can happen. But the probability of that is really astronomical. Really astronomical. So we don't really worry about that, right? When we go into a bathtub, we don't check one and the other side. We just step into it, right? So it's so unlikely. When something very, very unlikely happened, I mentioned St. Augustine, who was kind of telling that miracles are a little bit, is just our interpretation. You know, something very unlikely happened, and we interpret it as a miracle. This having said, as a scientist, as a human who is religious, I find the leg thing very unlikely, so unlikely that I do believe it was a miracle. Things can happen. Here, if you had groups that are very, very different, that would be bordering on a miracle, really. They are very, very similar. So selection is pretty much excluded. But besides, you have O1 and O3 to check. Because O1 and O3 are done in the beginning, you can compare the results of the measurement, of the test. Are they really equal, the groups? I've drawn this graph again. Because of randomization, all the selection criteria, they are not active, they are not working. Then the other things like testing and stuff, that essentially, because it works on both groups, you can compensate for that. You just look at the difference between O2 and O4. So I can slow down now, and I'm not sure if I talked about this one, but there is the external validity, threats to external validity. I said it in the very beginning, a couple of weeks ago. The problem here is with generalizing the results. Everything you have set up correctly, everything looked fine, precisely, logically, you conclude that there was an effect of intervention. Right? None of the internal validity threats took place, you conclude it. But then, there is still the question, can you generalize it to other populations? Remember the thought experiment I did in the very beginning, influence of intercourse on pregnancy. Suppose you select your subjects in an old people's home. Well, you will observe in your experiment that there was no effect of intercourse on pregnancy. Both groups had zero pregnancies. You can conclude, and you are justified to conclude it, right? This is what the data show you. You've done it very nicely. Still, you cannot generalize the results to general populations because the population that you've selected was very special. The women were not fertile. So that is an example of a threat to external validity. But there is something simpler than that. Here, this slide essentially says that generalization to everybody, to all the population, is always unsafe. It's never justified logically. I probably mentioned the problem of induction. Seeing 9,999 black raven, you cannot conclude that all ravens are black. You cannot, just, you know, theoretically. So that tells us that also that we cannot learn the world perfectly. We cannot. We are limited in that. We can come very close as possible, but we cannot learn it fully. Induction is never logically justified. So this is here is this first example of the external validity threat, interaction of the effect of interaction effect of testing. So the pretest makes the situation somewhat artificial. Here is the example. So I didn't talk about this, right? So there is an American movie, I think in 1950s, Gregory Peck. As a child, I remember him. He played in Westerns, one of those, you know, actors. He was playing a journalist in New York City, and he was given a task to investigate the issue of antisemitism. So, unjustified hatred of Jews. And he was talking to his fiancée, and he had a very good friend who was Jewish. I think this is the actor is here on the bottom. And he talked about this. And at some point an idea came up that he could, to really experience antisemitism, he should spread the news that he is a Jew himself. So he kind of, you know, casually said, oh, I'm interested in that topic, and it's not because I'm Jewish, but, you know, because of something else. So then the news spread among his colleagues that he was Jewish. At that time, U.S. was quite quite interesting. Jewish children often couldn't get into college. Some places wouldn't accept them. So antisemitism was not just something that happened in Europe. After the Second World War, there was still a problem in U.S. So what they did is, in the experiment, they checked how that movie influences people's views on antisemitism. And once he announced that he was Jewish, then problems started. There were some problems at work. He was dismissed, I think, for something. He reserved a hotel in a countryside. When they came here with his fiancée, they said, oh, that must be a mistake. We don't have a reservation in your name, you know. Somehow they learned he was Jewish, then Jews were not welcome there. In any case, the experiment was, they wanted to check the degree of antisemitism, how the movie influences that. So there was a test at the end, according to the architecture that you just saw here, right? At the end there was a test, X was the movie. So one of the groups saw the movie, the other didn't. But the problem is that they tested both groups before the movie. So they tested how antisemitic you are, asking questions, you know, kind of casual, sometimes a little hidden. In any case, the topic of antisemitism, the feelings toward Jews, popped up in the questionnaire. And then it turned out that the questionnaire made people sensitive to the issue, more sensitive. So an alternative, rival hypothesis is that it wasn't the movie. It was just, the test that made them sensitive to that. So the movie worked, but unnaturally stronger. That's what I want to say. Unnaturally stronger. Maybe the movie works normally, but it just didn't work as it normally would when you go to the movies and watch it, but in the lab it worked differently. Subjects, by the way, human subjects are very smart. They want to deliver you what you want, so they will try to guess what you want. And if they discovered that you wanted to test antisemitism, and of course it's not nice to be antisemitic, you know, they try to be less antisemitic in the second test. So people are smart. interaction of selection biases and the experimental variable, this design actually controls for that, because the randomization makes sure that the groups are the same, but still you have to watch out where you take subjects from. So that example with intercourse pregnancy experiment in an old people's home, that's a classical thing for this one. If you draw your subjects from a certain population, the results are going to be limited to that population. And there is a funny saying, a quote, that I read somewhere in a textbook for research design. All psychology is the science of behavior of psychology undergraduate students. Let me explain that. Psychology professors need subjects for their experiments because they want to study people. Getting subjects is not easy. You can put a newspaper announcement, ask people to call you, you have to pay them, whatever, compensation for the experiment. So it's not easy to get subjects. But they have so many people in their departments, students. Wow, what a nice pool of subjects. So what they do in most psychology departments is they make it mandatory for psychology students to participate in experiments. I don't know if it's everywhere, but at Carnegie Mellon they had 20 hours each semester mandatory participation in experiments. So whenever there was an announcement, there's an experiment, students would volunteer because they had to collect 20 hours of experiments. Actually, that makes sense because they also see experiments from the other side. They see what it is to be subjects. So it makes sense. In any case, whatever you are testing about humans is actually psychology undergraduate students. Very often it makes sense, but sometimes it doesn't. Right? They are probably not typical representatives of the population. They're definitely smarter than the average. They are students. They're smarter. Besides, and they are not probably mathematically very well-minded, so they are more on the humanities side. That makes a difference also. So we have to watch out the experiments. And you have to, of course, watch out when you work with people, where you take those people from. And I guess it's good to make a logical argument. If you read any paper in psychology or wherever there are experiments also in economics. When I was a doctoral student, I didn't have a lot of money, and I had a family. So I would volunteer to experiments just to earn money, because they compensated. I loved the economics experiments because my performance mattered. There was like a negotiation, you know, there were computer terminals. You had to negotiate with somebody anonymously. And so I loved that because instead of the base amount, let's say $20, I got 30 sometimes or 40. Just by my behavior. I love that. So I took part in experiments. It's actually fun. So the question is that does the selection of subjects matter, where you take them from for your experiment? If you can make an argument that it doesn't, then it's okay, I guess. If you read a paper in psychology, wherever there are experiments with humans, you will always see a precise description who the subjects were. They always will tell you, subjects were undergraduate psychology students, or subjects were recruited through a newspaper advertisement and they were compensated $20 for their participation. It's described so that the reader can make a judgment. Did it matter? Yes, it's important. Reactive effects of experimental arrangements. This idea is very simple, and also it makes sense. It's the artificiality of the setting. Whenever you are in an artificial setting, you behave differently. For example, suppose that that the department suddenly decides to send a committee of three people with a camera to see this class. So they come in, they ask if they may, and they set up a camera that goes through you. You ask a question, they record you. I bet that there would be a little bit of artificiality in this setting. So they called this, they discovered, and there are many things that are happening. I mentioned earlier that human subjects want to please the experimenter. I bet animals, pets, they will try that too. And they want to also guess the experimenter's intent and deliver what the experimenter wants. It's almost like a patient in a doctor's office. The doctor asks you, do you have headaches? I normally don't have headaches, but given the question, boy, yeah, last year I had a headache in November, right? You start kind of behaving a little bit differently. You want to please the doctor to give all the information necessary so that the doctor gives you a good diagnosis. This is also a somewhat different situation than just two friends talking. Do you have headaches? No, I don't, right? There is an effect known as the Hawthorne effect. That's the name of a place. I think it's in the US, although there's probably Hawthorne also in England. There was a factory where they observed workers, and they noticed that workers who are observed, they are recorded or observed, they are working differently. They are working more efficiently, harder, faster. That's where the name of the effect comes from, Hawthorne effects. When people know that they are being watched and studied, they behave differently. So every experiment that you conduct in an artificial setting is potentially subject to that effect. So you have to try to make the setting as natural as possible. In your labs, when you experiment with concrete or with water pipes or electric circuits, whatever you're doing, whenever you build those things to experiment with, you need to make sure that they are as similar as possible to identical devices in the world. So when you do the concrete, you try to do it the way that they would do in a construction site, right? That's a critical thing. The same with humans. When you have them in your lab, try to make the setting as natural as you can. And some of the tricks are mirrors, one-way mirrors, like in police movies, you know, they observe the suspect from behind a semi-transparent glass. So the accused doesn't see you, right? That's what can be done. You can have hidden cameras so they don't see that they are recorded. Other non-invasive naturalistic observations, as naturally as possible. Often you cannot avoid those artificialities, so you just need to do as good as you can, and we have no choice but to continue experimentation. Next one, as you see, it's getting more complicated. I think in this group, I'm teaching a similar course, that's why it's not my age. I'm teaching a similar class, and I don't remember where I talked about what, so that's why I'm asking. I believe I said in this class the thing that I always ask, I'm sure about this, I think we talked about this, what is the best searching algorithm or sorting algorithm, right? And the correct answer is it depends. It's a frustrating answer. When you ask somebody something and they tell you it depends, right? You still don't know anything. Which is the best experimental design? It depends, right? There is no design that you can call best. This one allows you to avoid some extra problems with some validity threats, but it doesn't come for free. Suddenly, instead of two groups, you have to have four groups. So instead of, let's say, 40 people, if you have people, you need 80 people. Boy, that's a lot. If you pay them, you need twice as much money. Finding them, signing them up, managing them is a lot of headache. But if you have that, this is a design that solves additional problems. You see that top two groups are essentially like in design four. The bottom two groups are extra. They are without the pretest. So this way, you can see how strong the pretest effect was on the post-test. another thing you can discover is you can have this validity threat, external validity threat. You can discover that the effect of the pretest, kind of warming up for the treatment. So with the movie Gentleman's Agreement, you could compare the first and the third group, and you would see how much the pretest warmed them up, what effect it had. Gentleman's Agreement, by the way, the title was because the fiancé was from the higher classes in around New York City, and she said, no, there is no written rule that Jews cannot be members of the golf club. It's just a gentleman's agreement that we, you know, that we don't accept them. That's why the name. So you can do extra things. That's what it is. But it's not free. The interaction of testing and treatment, comparing the first and the third, you can get that. That's probably the main thing. You can calculate actually the you can calculate precisely what effect the pretest had on the post-test. You can compare the second and the fourth group, and you see the effect of pretest on the post-test, for example. So it's kind of nice. It gives you additional information. The next design, we are winding down. Look at that. Not only from the four groups, we have two groups, but we don't have a pretest. And here is where I should go back to the miracles and the probabilities. Because you are randomizing, of course, the pretest did an additional check. Did the randomization work? There is a non-zero probability that randomization didn't work too well, and in your groups you have different people. But luckily, randomization typically works. The probability that the groups are going to be different is very, very little, really very little. So if you are willing to take the risk that a miracle happens here, this is a good design. You don't need the pretest. Essentially, you are taking a little risk, but that risk is really manageable. This is the risk that we are taking every day. Every day that you are coming to the university, you are risking death on the road, driving or walking, right? These are all risks that you can manage. This is the type of risk, probably even less probability that things like that will happen. So simpler design, less work, avoid some things like warming the external validity threat, but good enough for most practical purposes. I would say if the number of your group, of your subjects is small, remember, subjects can be people, animals, samples of concrete, whatever you're doing. These are the subjects. If the number is very small, you may want to do the pretest because it's the law of large numbers. In a small population, you will see bigger variance. So, for example, if I have, let's say we have only two people here, you and you, a gentleman and a lady, and I assign you to do the different groups. Boy, these groups are going to be really different, right? Because you will be in one and you will be in the other. If we have four people, the chance that two ladies will be in one group, two gentlemen in the other group, is very high, actually. What is the chance? One fourth the chance that we will have two ladies in one group, two gentlemen in the other group. That's unacceptable. But if you have 40 people, 80 or 100, probability is on your side. The chance that these groups are going to be different is really astronomically small. So this is when you are doing this. A simplification that works just fine. And that's all in terms of the experimental designs. A reminder, these are the three different classes: experimental, quasi-experimental, which I'm going to talk about now, and factorial designs. Factorial just extend the two classes to multiple factors, multiple things that you manipulate at the same time. I said it already, but remember that threads is just a checklist, and it's you can extend the list. Somebody will extend the list. We just, as we have new designs, new ways, new situations, the list can be extended. So this is just a checklist. Nothing magical about it. That was on one of the slides. You see a problem, you formulate a hypothesis, and then you test it by means of an experiment. Don't feel bound by existing experimental designs. I'll have a couple of slides on that idea in the other series. Each of the designs was invented at some point, and some of them very recently, like the number 4, the truly experimental design, that's early 20th century, 1920s, not long ago. And the others are probably still newer, the more complicated ones. The purpose of the course, I wanted to remind you again, each of you will deal with some experimental component, because whatever you do in your dissertation, unless you are a mathematician, if you are a mathematician, a proof is just enough. But everything else needs some empirical validation, empirical testing, showing that what you've done is good. So that's the first goal. But the second goal is to make you a critical recipient of research results, and that you will deal with every day. You've been dealing with it every day. Statements by people about the world, you hear them daily. Politicians are wonderful in that. But also scientists and economists are having all kinds of theories. So being a critical recipient is a good thing. It's expected from you, from educated people. Very good. Any questions? I assume you will interrupt me anytime you have a question. So it's a small enough group. I booked this small room on purpose so that we are close to one another. So then this is a shorter presentation, and some of the slides are repeated. I'm going to rush through them. Quasi-experimental designs. This is essentially, you remember this slide, we want to learn the causal structure. What is the causal graph underlying the observations? The problem is that we cannot always perform experiments with randomization. I gave you two examples of experiments just for the purpose of explaining what is going on. One was intercourse pregnancy experiment. The other one is influence of smoking on lung cancer. I cannot imagine any of these two experiments being conducted in reality. You would need a permission to perform any experiment with human and animal subjects, and you would not get that permission. Did I talk about the history of why we need that permission? It's essentially people were abusing experimentation. You all know about the Second World War, experiments in the concentration camps, right? They were doing experiments there. In fact, the experiments were useful. We didn't talk about it, right? For example, there were experiments on women cervical cancer. I don't know what exactly they were doing, but I know that there were experiments like that. And actually they found interesting things, interesting from the point of view of science. Of course, the experiments were destructive. They often were killing the patients. But, you know, who cares? The inmates were dying anyway. They would kill them anyway, right? So they were doing experiments. There was an ethical dilemma after the war. Should scientists use those results? And they ended up actually using them. I know that because my wife was working on cervical cancer, and so she knew about those experiments. That's how I know it. So the ethical dilemma, should we use those results? They were doing a lot of experiments. In Ravensbrück, it was a women's camp, and they called the women inmates who were undergoing experiments, they called them rabbits, other inmates, cruelty. There's an excellent book by Countess Lanskoronska, a wonderful book. I definitely recommend it to everybody. A piece of Polish history and a book written by as strong a woman as a Polish woman can be. Polish women are strong, in case you didn't know that. And she is really a strong woman. Definitely worth reading. Different titles. I think Polish was Wspomnienia Wojenne. English was, I think, Michelangelo in Ravensbrück, because that was her research area. She was a scientist. She was giving lectures to other women in the camp just to do something. Anyway, there were experiments going on there. But there was also experiment after the Second World War in the United States, I think it's called Tuskegee Syphilis Study. It was in the military. They had, of course, some soldiers had venereal diseases. And they decided not to treat some of the soldiers just to see what will happen. And they were black soldiers. So they did not treat black soldiers who had syphilis for a few years just to see what will happen. That came out. That was announced later. And this is believed to be one of the important reasons why for every experiment that where you have subjects that are human or animals, you need a permission. So even if you have a simple user interface study, you are a computer scientist, and you want to test two different user interfaces with people, you need a permission of a committee at the Białystok University of Technology. There is a committee that does this. So every experiment requires a permission. Of course, every medical experiment, absolutely, and others. So long thing on the side, just to say that some experiments are impractical, or you would never get a permission to do them, to randomize. So what you need to do is you need to somehow inject a little bit randomization wherever you can in order to draw useful conclusions. And this whole class of designs are in this kind of situations. So what should you do then? There are many natural settings where you can do experimentation and inject a little bit of randomization if you can. These are called collectively quasi-experimental designs. There are two quotes, but no need to read these quotes now. If I remember correctly them, the idea here is, and you will see that clearly later when we talk about causal discovery from data, that there are many ways of learning the world. There's a saying in English, there are many ways, there is more than one way to skin a cat. A cruel saying. There's more than one way to skin a cat, to take off a skin of a cat. Essentially, to learn the world, there are many ways you can do it. One way is an experiment with randomization. Another one is quasi-experimental designs. Yet another is observation. All of these are useful in learning what is going on. So we should never dismiss non-experimental designs as worthless, because they are giving us a lot of information. So these quotes are essentially saying that the fewer rival hypotheses a hypothesis has, the better, the more support you have for that hypothesis, because there are no other explanations. So every method that eliminates rival hypotheses is good. That's the thing I already talked about this. The quasi-experimental designs are here. You've seen these several times already. You've seen the notation. Then just a few architectures. Time series experiment. So how does it go? When I think about this experiment, I often think about the common sense observation that a mother knows the child best. I've heard it from a physician, about being a physician, a doctor. A doctor who is not a pediatric doctor, who is treating children, especially babies. Babies cannot talk. Babies just cry. A pediatrician who is not listening to the mother is missing a lot, because the mother knows the baby the best. The mother spends day and night with the baby and observes. So look at this design. What you have here is you have a series of observations It's almost like a mother observing the baby every day. Yes, a number of these observations. Then you have a treatment. So X, something happens. I don't know, baby falls out of the crib. So the mother, concerned mother, observes the baby for another few moments, days, hours, or whatever. And the mother says, something happened because the behavior of my child has changed. This design is precisely like that. You have a number of observations, you have an intervention, and then you keep observing. What happens? What happened after the intervention? So what can you observe here? You can observe a number of things. These are five different experiments, kind of, you know, symbolically. I wanted to give an example of what could happen. In the top one, what you see is that the intervention had a lasting effect. What is an example of that? You learn a skill. The treatment is like a course. This course is a treatment on you, right? Hopefully, the effect is going to be lasting. The skill that you will learn will be lasting, so you increased maybe your knowledge or something. The second one, you see that there is an effect of the treatment, but it's transient. It's over after a little bit. So it's like, you know, the child falls, you are concerned, the child is crying, behaving differently, but an hour later, it's just, you know, smiling, bubbling, and behaving normally. That would be that observation. Alcohol, any substance that changes you, right? Alcohol, any medicine like insulin or something changes you, but it has a transient effect. So when there is a treatment that has transient effect, you see something like that. In the third case, I guess we see only maturation. You know, things are changing naturally, but the treatment had no effect. In the fourth case, I guess you may be tempted to think there is an effect at that moment, but because of the observation, it's not abnormal to see that increase. It's just probably noise. So you see that it's nice to have multiple observations, because then you can make a judgment that one thing between 04 and 05, that was just noise, because I've seen these kind of things happening more often. The last one, I guess, I don't know, you may think
someone
that...
Dies.
Pardon?
Someone dies.
Yes. Some object dies. That's the experimental mortality case. But I just didn't want to draw it across. You may claim that the treatment made the slope bigger or something. Again, in any case, what you see that what happens when you observe a time series like this. That's an interesting design, right? There's no randomization, nothing that you can compare to in terms of another subject or another group, but still it's a very useful experiment, essentially observation, and you see what the effect of the treatment is.
Doesn't that deal with the history problem? Essentially, it's a graph of a history.
Not really. It deals it in the following way. I told you several times already that research design and experimental work has a lot of common sense. You can be accused always of a problem, just like you can go to court for no reason with anybody, right? We talked about that. You can always criticize somebody. So somebody could say, okay, history. In the first case, look, you haven't excluded history effect between 04 and 05. Something happened. It wasn't your treatment, but something happened there. You have no way of excluding it. But my response would be, that's just like, you know, a thunder falling from the sky on a clear day, right? Why on earth did that history effect happen between 04 and 05 and not between 01 and 02, right? That would be my response. So you can be accused always of a problem, but you always need to give a, you know, think about this. Because you have so many observations, then you can make this argument that, you know, okay, it could have happened, but why on earth exactly between 04 and 05? That's quite a coincidence, isn't it? I remember seeing a few memes when there was, you know, there were in Polish politics, December, I think, when the new government started, there was this affair with a new law that they brought to the parliament, Ustawa Wiatrakowa, I think. And then within days, I think after that, European Commission decided to release funds to Poland. And very quickly, Siemens won that thing. Remember many memes asking, what a coincidence, right? I would say here, what a coincidence that history, in fact, happened exactly between 04 and 05. That's almost like a joke, right? That would be my response. But you could postulate that.
I want to ask about second one.
Second?
Yeah, between fifth and sixth point in the second line, it shouldn't be straight line.
Between the
sixth after the X.
Oh yes, of course. Sorry, I think I probably draw the line first and then put the points.
Yeah.
I did it quickly. Yes. Yeah, I guess you get the idea. The weakness, of course, history. That's exactly what you said. It's a problem. But why exactly was it between 04 and 05? The same with the instrumentation, regression, selection. The multiple measurements essentially are making it possible for you to see that influence of the measurements, see the instrumentation change, etc. It could all happen, but why on earth did it happen between 04 and 05? Right? That's the argument. External validity, the only problem is, of course, that the selection of the population that you are studying. But that is always the problem. The last one is sometimes some manipulations, some interventions work with a delay. You know, you tell a joke, nobody is laughing. And then an hour later, the first person starts laughing and the last person laughs when they get home, right? And there's a delay sometimes in the manipulation. So you have to watch out for that because you may not observe immediately the effect, but a little later. But very often when we do experiments, we have reasons to think that the measurements are needed. Probably next week, I will tell you, we're going to talk about problems in the laboratory, what kind of problems. Some famous people did a lot of terribly stupid things in experimentation. One of them is Sigmund Freud. You know the name Sigmund Freud, the father of psychoanalysis. He was a very ambitious young man, like you are, all ambitious young people. He really wanted to be successful. A young doctor in Vienna with ambition to become famous, to do research. And he was trying different things. He ended up with psychoanalysis, of course, as you know, which had a lot of problems. Many people thought it was religion and not science, until this day. In fact, I think Freud is pretty much destroyed, his psychoanalysis, I think. Although there are people who still believe it's good work, but I think there are few people like that. In any case, when he was still searching, he discovered cocaine. Cocaine in the late 19th century was just, you know, you could go to a drugstore and ask, can I have a pound of cocaine? Sure. They would scoop with a spoon, give you a bag, you just go home with a pound of cocaine. People didn't understand it yet because it was a new drug. They started importing it from South America, from coca leaves. It was an extract. People knew that if you take a sniff of cocaine, you feel good, right? They knew that. And Freud thought, wow, what a wonderful thing. That's a miracle drug that I can use in all kinds of psychiatric problems. He started treating heroin addiction because they understood that heroin was a bad thing at that time. Heroin, that's poppy seeds, I think, from Asia. So he started prescribing his patients cocaine. They credit him with 50 or so new drug addicts because they realized that that cocaine was also addictive, and they kicked the habit of opium, of heroin, but they became addicted to cocaine, those people. Anyway, he did an experiment that the students of Freud very carefully hid from the world. He wrote four papers known today as coca papers, cocaine papers. And there was somebody late 20th century who actually searched them in the old journals in Vienna, in Austria, found those papers, because when they published collected works of Freud, they carefully omitted those papers. But the papers were really fun. I have at least one copy of one of the papers. Maybe I have the whole book, I don't remember. I went and looked in my library. Here's one of the experiments that he describes in the paper. That's exactly this architecture. He was testing the influence of cocaine on the muscle strength and on the feeling, or kind of, you know, on the psyche. He was the only subject in that experiment. So he writes very carefully, like every good scientist should, 7:05, I woke up. 7:30, I took the first sniff of cocaine. 0.05 grams. I write down feeling of euphoria. And then there was an instrument. I think I've seen a photograph somewhere. There were like two different handles, and you had to pull those handles as strong as you can, and you could read the force. So we will talk about that, the subject experiment and effects. That was a terrible thing to do for him to be the only subject who knew what he wanted. He wanted to show that cocaine was a wonderful drug. And, you know, he writes down, okay, 72 newtons, the force. Another sniff, 75, right? And this is essentially the paper. You know, he did it over the period of 2 or 3 days, taking sniffs of cocaine and checking his strength. Exactly this thing. Of course, in that situation, he knew when to measure. One of you asked about the timing, right? Of course, he knew when to measure. He also knew how quickly cocaine works. He knew it. Because he knew that when he takes a sniff of cocaine, then after whatever, I don't know, I've never taken cocaine, but I assume after 5 or 8 hours, the effect is over. So he knew that. So the measurements were within the time that the cocaine was working. So when you do this type of experiment, you probably will have a basic understanding of that intervention. Right? You will know what it is. Suppose you measure influence of alcohol on you. Well, you know that when you drink, after a few minutes, you are jolly, right? So that's what you would do. Of course, history happened at that very moment, but not very likely. An interesting design that is not really bad, very simple, very, very simple. Think about a mother and a baby. That's a good thing. We cannot dismiss the observation of the mother. I thought about an anecdote. I may have told you that Herb Simon, one of my advisors, was caught by a reviewer. Reviewer wrote back to him, no, you have to have some validity test, statistical test for your claim. And I think he had one subject in his experiment. This was a very specific experiment with the protocol analysis. He was actually not interested in a hypothesis like is there effect or is there no effect, but he was tracing the subject, working on a Tower of Hanoi problem, and he was describing essentially the steps that the subject took, and they wanted a test. So he is known, there's an anecdote at Carnegie Mellon statistics department, that Herb Simon ran downstairs, because it was from the second to the ground floor, and asked, hey guys, tell me, what is the statistical test that will be the easiest, that my hypothesis will pass the easiest? Don't do that, of course, that's not a very good thing. So they gave him some test because he said, well, this stupid reviewer wants me to do a statistical test, and it doesn't make any sense to do a test in that situation. And I agree with him, it didn't make any sense. So once I asked Herb Simon during a meeting, how do you get away with one subject? Because, of course, you know that we need multiple subjects, we need a test, etc. So how do you get away with one subject? And he said, well, you know, it depends who is asking. if a biologist will ask me, then I will say, oh, no, he will not ask me, because biologists are used to it. That's the, you know, mother and child thing. A biologist doing experiments with a chimpanzee, for example, knows that chimpanzee and sometimes can test the effect of intervention on the, just one subject, one animal. And then he says, well, if an economist asks me, I will say, one subject is better than no subjects. And that was ironic and very, it was very pinchy towards economists. He was always very critical of economics, saying that it's completely detached from reality. He got a Nobel Prize in economics, but for a theory that says that the economic theories of maximization of profits or maximization of utility are essentially wrong. That was his Nobel Prize. Anyway, that was an interesting thing. So in case of biologists, the same thing, really. You can really have one group because you have many measurements, many observations. You see what is happening. And if you observe, like a mother, you know, you observe your child for 3 months, a baby, and then something happens, the baby falls, and you see a different behavior, boy, I mean, there could be history effect, but she saw the baby fell, right? That was so. I think it's an interesting experimental design and one that we can use a lot. When you are in a relationship, you see that your husband, wife, boyfriend, girlfriend just behaves differently. Because you know them, you know your mother, your brother, your sister, your friend, you essentially see that there is something different. Of course, you can be wrong, but similar. So we do that too. Next design. That design, there's going to be really very few designs. So I think there's just one more or two more. This is a design that I remember in 1970s, I heard that about experiments with cows. When they were playing classical music to cows, they were giving more milk. And they were playing rock music, they were giving less milk. There was no heavy metal at the time, there was rock.
That's true.
There was no rock, or true that they are giving less milk?
They give less milk.
Yeah. Yeah, I read about this in 1970s, so it's a very possible thing. Yeah.
But it's true, because I have my own cows, and they give more milk when they listen to music.
Do you play the music, really?
Yes.
All the time?
Not all the time, but most of the day.
That's interesting. You know, this design is to test this kind of hypothesis. Suppose you indeed suspect that they give more milk when they have classical music, then well, you have to have something to compare to. Yes, you could have, of course, two different buildings with cows. You play classical music in one building and nothing in the other. That would be possible, but it may be difficult to do. And you would have to randomize, of course, for every cow, flip a coin too. So a simpler experiment is to play music, let's say classical music, one day, and then measure how much milk they gave you, and then play rock music the other day. And then again classical music and rock music. And then you have those repetitions. If you do it sufficiently many times, you can exclude all kinds of history effects, like there was something that happened and so. And you can say over time they gave more milk when they were given classical music. I wonder, unfortunately he left, I wonder what experiments he did. It's a pity he didn't hear this. But so whenever the treatment has a transient effect, like they will, I bet the cows will forget the music after a few hours, right, when it stops playing. People forget too. So I guess it is a transient effect. Then they give you milk. And there's an anecdote about my colleague when I was a student, undergraduate student at Warsaw Technical University in 1970s. A colleague told me the following story. He got a homework from calculus. He had to differentiate some formulas or integrate whatever. And he went to a party, came back home at 4 a.m., drunk completely, and he realized he needed to do homework. So he sat down, started doing it, and he was amazed how easy it went. Wow, he thought. Everything was nicely canceling out, you know, beautiful results. So he thought, well, every time I have a homework like this, I'll just go to a party, I will drink a lot. And then when he had a few hours of sleep, he woke up, double-checked, and there was an error in every step that he was making, right? Alcohol has a transient effect if you want to test things like that. Freud, of course, could compare his strength on a day that he took a sniff of cocaine and with the day that he didn't. That would be a good experiment. So we were wondering how you experimentally tested it, because there is a problem with this design. Well, history, of course, you know, if history happens, it will have to happen each time you give classical music, right? That's it. That is very unlikely. Nobody would find it admissible. So, for instance, external validity threat here is the last one, multiple treatment interference. That's the last one here that is known. The problem here is that maybe the cows are giving more milk after having heard rock music the previous day. So, you know, during the rock music, they were kind of, reacting to it.
Yeah, it's always 1 or 2 days of delay.
Aha.
if we change their food, in food it's 2 or 3 days of delays when they start to give more milk. It's if it is better part or even worse.
Interesting.
So it's don't grow up instantly or drop down.
Did you do it formally or just observing?
Observing.
Yeah. You see, there is nothing wrong with that observation. You haven't done randomization. You haven't done any of these things. I have no problems believing you. No, not at all. In fact, you
they even react,
you know your cows essentially.
When we put on a normal radio like RMF Max, they even react to that.
Really?
Yes.
Positively. Wow.
We have react to light too. It can be dark all day or night. There are a lot of stuff which can make difference in quality of milk, even quantity.
Incredible. You were a scientist long before you started being a doctoral student. Each one of us is a scientist in that respect, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with it, and we should do it. We should absolutely do it. Remember the experiment with limes in the British Navy? Yeah, it was just an idea. Maybe fresh fruits. That's a good idea. They discovered it. We experiment as children. If you had children, if you have a younger brother, or if you observe them, they are experimenting. Sometimes we believe that this is a bad behavior, but they are experimenting. A child discovers a switch, turns on the light, then turns off, on, and off. Then we get irritated, saying, don't play with that, because it disturbs us, and also the bulb will break when you do that, right, too many times. But the child keeps doing it, essentially checking if indeed that action brings that reaction. I really think it's experimenting. It's not playing on our nerves. It's just experimenting, naturally. I think we should keep doing this. So this intertwining may be the reason why there's more milk. Probably it's not true, as you say, but maybe that intertwining is the reason why they are giving more milk on the days with classical music. And that means that you cannot generalize it. So if you apply classical music all the time, maybe it's not going to work. Again, I'm saying it as somebody who did not hear you. I don't have the additional evidence, of course. Observation about the delay and things. But if you have an experiment like this, you do it, you know, thoroughly, carefully, etc., you cannot generalize it, because even if you observe more milk on those days, maybe it's just in that building where you intertwine rock music with classical music. So trying different things, which is what you did, is a good idea, I think. This one is a additional thing that was used a lot in psychology. where we have a treatment that is identical. It's not identical, but it's the same. They were testing short-term memory, long-term memory, and they were trying having people remember syllables, nonsense syllables, like three letters groups, or nonsense numbers, like, you know, three-digit numbers. If you have ever had psychology, you know that our short-term memory has limited capacity, just five plus minus two items. Those items can be single digits, single letters, single syllables, single words, single titles of books too. But you cannot keep in short-term memory more than five plus minus two. Some people think it's seven plus minus two. You need to bring it to long-term memory, and it takes, I think, if I remember, roughly 8 seconds to bring something from short-term memory to long-term memory, to remember for longer. In any case, they were testing these humans, and they were offering them different things, very similar materials, identical from the former perspective, but different, so that there is no transition. If they learn the numbers in MA, or syllables, it would be useless in the second stage. They had to learn new numbers or syllables. So these were the types of experiments. Very similar to the previous one, as you notice, but just the materials are different. The effect of treatment should not be lasting. This is used when the effect of treatment is lasting and the stimulus should not be repeated. Oh yeah, of course. Well, the stimulus is lasting, not the treatment. The treatment can be is transient. Nonsense syllables. Another one is influence of group opinions. There are methods actually to converge on an opinion as a group. There's a method called Delphi method. Suppose I want to get a probability of something, and I ask each one of you to give anonymously a number. That usually requires a computer in front of you, so you give a number, the software calculates the average, and displays the average on the screen, or displays all the responses without telling who is who. Then the second round, I'm asking the same question, give me that number, and people do it again and again until they converge. It turns out that people do converge to a number in that. Delphi method works that way. You give feedback of the group opinion and people converge. There's another thing that I'm thinking about in this context that you may have seen already. If not, you should see as educated people and scientists. Experiments by Solomon Ash about group influence on people's opinion. A, B, C. These are three short lines. Okay. Now, the question to you is, this line, which is D, is it like A, B, or C? Suppose I measure it exactly, you know, it's one of the three. Which of the three lines is like this one? You have your opinion by now already. It's a quick look. Now, the experiments were the following. You were the subject, the only subject, and you were actors. I paid to be here. And when before you came, you were behind. You didn't hear that. I said, when he comes, say C, okay? C. Everybody say C when he comes. And then he comes, and I ask, D. Which one is it? Which one is it similar to?
C, of course.
C. Yeah. C. You?
C.
C. C. C. C. C. And you?
A.
It turns out that I thought 70% of the people said in his situation said C. Incredible experiment. Solomon Ash was born in Warsaw. Obviously Jewish first and last name, but then worked in US. Incredible experiments, the pressure of the groups. Why do you need to know it? Because as educated people, you should realize the pressures that are there around you. The media, today, all the media are saying the same thing. Almost all the media say the same thing. Remember, you are practically every day in these kind of situations, you have to always have your own opinion, like you did, right? You said, hey, yeah, that was a good answer.
The same is with the red light. Everybody's stuff, but if one person going on the red light, the other person will start going also on the red light.
That's also influence of other people. So it's also done in the group conformity experiments, similar designs. We are almost done, I think, 10 more minutes. Here is a setting. You see that the only difference between the truly experimental design and this one, so number 4, I think, and this number 10, is that there is no randomization. It's an experiment that you do, that you can do as a teacher. Let's say you are teaching, you have two sections of the same class, 20 people in each group, you can treat one group and not the other. The only problem with this design is that the groups may not be equivalent. So you need to have a good, you need to believe, know that that the groups are identical and eliminate anything that is not identical. If you wanted to do that as an experiment, you would have to randomize every student in those groups. And because they are naturally occurring, they will not even know that you are experimenting, right? You can do that. That design. I bet, as a teacher, I experiment. Every year I do different things. And I learn which things worked, which did not. That's exactly this design. Well, regression works only when one group is based on extreme scores. No randomization, remember. But if you choose both groups as on the same extreme score, then they are the same. Maturation, if the groups are really not the same, like you treat psychotherapy patients and normal population, there can be regression. So. You need to essentially make sure that those groups are very, very similar. They're almost the same. Groups of students not necessarily are similar. Think about this. Very often in our university, they create groups based on the last name. So in the morning, let's say there are people from A to K. In the afternoon, from L to Z. Are they the same? They may be different. People with last names starting with ABCD are often asked first in school. Did you notice that? That has influence on them over time, over years. They come better prepared just because they think, or maybe they will ask me. Another reason why they can be different, if they self-select, they select the morning session or afternoon session, maybe the morning session people are those who are studying full-time and are not working. And afternoon people are those who work in the morning and come to school. They are different. People working, even though I advise not to work, people working are usually better at organizing their time. They are better at multitasking. They are different. So they can be different. So you have to think about these kind of things. Are they different or are they the same? Oh boy, this is called counterbalance designs. When you have several treatments and you want to offer all treatments to the same group, if you did it in one group, then there would be influences of the treatments. I did an experiment like this when I was a doctoral student. I had a way of explaining calculation in expert systems. I collected subjects, and what I ended up doing is I had every subject go through exercises with explanation, without explanation, and I think there was a third group with a different explanation. What I did is I changed the order. So if one explanation had influence on the other, then in another group it was reversed. If you look at the numbers of the axes, you will notice that they kind of evened out. X1 is before X2, 1 twice, and it's after x2 twice 2. So it's pretty much balance, counterbalance. So if there are any advantages to having x1 first over x2, they the other groups don't have that advantage. The only problem is with this design is that there may be some complex things happening with those interactions that we don't know. And of course, things, it's so complex that there may be many things happening to people, to animals too, I think. All kinds of maturations, practice, repeated testing. So, but in general, it is actually used in psychology. You will see that in the psychology papers. I think this is the last one. It is a design that has been applied in practice. Maybe it's before, the one before last, but the last one is very similar. This is done in natural settings. Suppose you want to see, what do we have recently? Okay, we had this experiment giving every mother, every family who has children, 500 zloty every month, right? It wasn't really an experiment. I mean, they had a theory, a hypothesis that will help the family, etc. I mean, there are good reasons for doing this, but it was in a way an experiment. And suppose that you want to find out what the effect was, right? How would you like to do it? Well, ideally, you would like to pick families, randomize them, and give half of the families 500 zloty a month for every child, and the other half not. But could you do it? Of course not. That would be, of course, completely unfair, unjust, if you wanted to do an experiment like this. Now, can you learn something from this experiment? That's the question. Here is the design that tries to do something. Essentially, when you have those families applying for 500 zloty, you randomize them in the following way. You always give them the money, so the treatment is always there. But you randomize them to be looked at before or a year later, let's say. And before means, you know, you give an interview, you talk to them, ask about their budget, have they been on vacation, where do they find the money for books for the children? I mean, all kinds of things, okay? Their social life, their economic life in the family. The other group who were selected randomly are not asked in the beginning, but they are asked the same things in the end. Now look, those two groups are identical because you randomized. So you selected those families for the first group. They are the same as the second group. The only difference is that they are tested in the beginning and the other group is at the end. So now what you can do is, the first group, of course, they get the money, but you say goodbye, etc. You don't talk with them anymore. And the second group, you talk afterwards. So you test essentially a group of people and see the effect that that experiment, that giving money, had on them. You look at their economic condition, you know, social interactions, etc., etc. That would be an experiment that I would imagine testing this. Of course, some of you will say, you could just talk to those people before giving money and after giving money, the same families. What would be the bad thing about it? I can imagine that suppose I introduce a four-day work week. I think our left-wing parties are proposing something like this. It's after Germany. German parties are proposing the same thing. I could do that, and I would ask all of you, how do you feel about 5 days a week working? Then, okay, from today it's 4 days. A year later, I ask each of you, how do you feel with 4 days a week? Everybody feels tempted to say, I feel great, wonderful. Because, why do you say that? Because you really love it, right? You love those 4 days. And you don't want that to be taken away from you, right? The same here. People who were tested in the beginning, I think that test, that asking about their condition, might have influence on what they will answer to you a year from now, yes? So you are you are avoiding the effect of pretest on the posttest essentially. If you don't, if you leave those people alone, and those that you want to ask a year from now, you leave them untouched. You don't ask them. Again, these are thought experiments, but there were actually real experiments conducted in the U.S. That I read about, in factories, in cities, schools. So there is a little bit of randomization, and there is no possible accusation of being unfair. Let me see. Here are some examples of that. There are some weaknesses, of course. There can be history effect here, definitely. Instrumentation, mortality, things like that can be happening. Let me see. I think, no, there are two more. Just two more. I think I should finish it. It's 10 past or almost 10. Yeah. So let me just finish that in 1 or 2 minutes. Campbell and Stanley say it was probably never used. But look, the only difference here is that you have also a group that doesn't get the treatment, completely doesn't get the treatment. That way you can potentially control for history, for example. If something happened, it happened to everybody, and you will see that effect of history in the third and fourth group. But of course, in some situations, you cannot do that. Like with the 500 example that I gave you, you cannot do that. That would be unfair. A last design, very easy to understand. The only thing you do is the second group that doesn't get the treatment. And that controls for that history thing happening between the things that observations of the treatment. So please note that you can probably have another design invented yourself, depending on the situation. I think, just the last sentence before I have to leave, let you go, look at your situation, what you want to learn in your problem, in your lab, in your dissertation. First, see what you think is happening, think about your hypothesis, what you think is happening, and then think what you would like to do before you even pick the design. And then, you know, pick one of the designs. If none of them fits, see if you can extend your design, if you can do it in such a way that you will convince yourself that nothing else could be a possible explanation. So it's not a magical number. Here are just collective experiences of what people have done. Great. I have to finish. I'll finish just last 2 or 3 slides and then quasi-experimental designs. That will collectively take me 30 minutes, not more, and then we can continue with other things. So, any questions?
No.
So, thank you.
Yes? Is it really possible to control history in any way? What I mean is the two groups should be isolated, right? In terms of long experiments, like a couple of days, if the groups aren't isolated, they can, or they could communicate between each other, and this could influence the.
Yes.
This could influence, and I would count this as a history, actually.
Yes. Could happen, absolutely. Even in the best design, you know, you have 4 groups, randomization, everything, also something can happen. If you read any paper with an experiment, you will see that they describe everything. Subjects were recruited from among da-da-dam. They were paid $20 for the participation. One subject could not show up. It was done in the evening after work. You will see all the details so that as a reader you can form your opinion. Do I believe that or not? Because anything can happen despite the best design. You know, the first example with intercourse and pregnancy. What I liked about this a lot is that we understand that problem and we understand why people, for example, you know, you tell them to do something, they go home and they do what they want, right? You have no control. And it's a typical situation in experimentation. You don't have full control. Well, US engineers have actually more control than anybody else because in the lab you can control the temperature and everything. But a cleaning man comes in the evening, opens the window. I think I gave that example. Screws up your experiment. You don't even know about it. Things like that could happen. Good. So thank you very much. I will just mark the presence. So thank you. It's finished. I'm stopping.